Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Our Matrix server is about as free as internet chat can be. Join the existing rooms or create your own at chat.freetalklive.com.
It's Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Gardner Gold, and now we get to dive into a special interview with researcher Chris Graves on the Salem Witch Trials, legends, and more. It is time, and we're going to go straight into the mind meld with Chris Graves. He's joining us on the program now, and he is... I like the avatar image, Chris. That's awesome. Chris has the picture of the Taunton... Is it the Taunton Triangle? What do they call that, Chris?
Well, yeah, it's the Bridgewater Triangle, and right now my computer is telling me the reason why my camera's not hooked up right now is I have to restart it.
Oh, okay. So, which would you...
Couldn't be at the worst moment, either.
Well, no, I actually was watching somebody else just a little while ago, and they had to restart their computer or something like that. Do you want to restart it, or do you want to go voice? Your preference.
Oh, I can do voice. Yeah, we have the articles and everything. Yeah, I didn't want to miss this for the world, believe me.
Oh, great, man. And it is kind of cool because I want to put you up a little bit bigger in the screen because I want to see you talk and see that thing vibrate like something from a sci-fi movie. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Halloween.
Yeah, it's like something from a video game. Chris Graves is awesome. I want to show you, Chris, I'm going to put myself in the image real quick because I want to show everybody your Rumble page. Okay, so now we're going to go back and show Chris's Rumble page, Digging with Chris Graves. Sign up over there, everybody. Chris has so many angles, so many different types of things that he covers. And, of course, there is his handsome mug with the glasses and the beard and the hat, and he's looking cool, along with the great Don Jeffries. Don, boy, I don't know, Chris, if you got to see Don's chat with David Beto about FDR. From
I was in there. Yeah, I was handing out. Peter Sikosh was really excited too, because he's Don's better researcher, in my opinion, and he knows all about the FDR stuff. So that was a big deal for Peter.
Oh yeah, the criminal mind of FDR, and if you read some of Amity Schley's stuff, the opening of her book, The Forgotten Man, about FDR and what a master he became at gaming the system and using the carrot and stick approach of showering funds on special interests, but promising that they would get the funds, but waiting to give it to them until they gave him political support. Then they'd get the money. This vast expansion of the welfare game, that's excellent. But it opens with guys on a train talking about how Stalin was making the trains run on time, how much they admired Stalin. Everybody, virtually everybody in the Roosevelt administration knew, including Stalin, including Roosevelt, that Stalin was a bloodthirsty madman. Oh, yeah. And yet they adored the guy. Talk about a... And that sort of perversion, Chris, it's weird because we think about these historical figures and we think about the fact that they could actually associate and distance that reality.
Yeah.
Meeting and smoking cigars with Winston Churchill, knowing what Winston Churchill had already been responsible for doing and knowing that you had secretly been in touch with Churchill to say, I will, and literally I'm quoting verbatim, I will do anything I can to get the United States into the war after Roosevelt had run as a peace candidate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So we see these people on television. Sometimes we meet these weird culprits in our lives who are pathological or sociological or so narcissistic. You're just like, well, I'm going to get away from that guy. And maybe you hear something about them later where they did something stupid in their life or their business, or maybe something even worse, right?
But this is
systematized on such a broad scale through the political machine that it becomes almost like it's like you're inculcated to just expect it. These are ghouls. They're monstrous things.
It's the acceptable reality.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. Actually, and I didn't mean that to be a segue, but I want to show the audience a little bit of something that I sent over to you.
Yeah.
And it describes what is going to be sort of the starting subject for us tonight, which I think people will really enjoy. And it's about the witch trials. Now, as you know, Chris, and I've mentioned this on the show before, it's funny that when I was showing that witch down in Pennsylvania, they had the picture of my friends Kelly Owen and Bob Ford, because Kelly Owen and Bob Ford, they're also in the Horror Writers Association, and they know they're also friends with both of the people who wrote this book about the witch hunts.
Right.
One of them's passed away, my friend Rocky Wood. So just to let everybody know, you know, my last name is Goldsmith. It's not Jewish. It's English and Irish. The Goldsmiths came over, I don't know when, but my middle name is Gardner, and that's from the Gardner family. There was this guy, Richard Gardner, who came over on the Mayflower, signed the Mayflower Compact. And the Gardner family, along with four other families, went north from Plymouth Plantation, because Plymouth Plantation, and Chris, you're probably aware of this, they actually would expel people who were not strict enough Calvinists.
That's right.
Yeah, and so whether that was the reason or they just thought it was a good opportunity to find land on the coastline where they could start fishing and doing things like that, I don't know. But the Gardner family helped found Salem, and they were one of the founding families there. So that's Isabella Stewart Gardner, married into that family. That's where you get the Gardner Museum in Boston. And we talked to Toby Leary. I wasn't aware until I heard it like the second time. They have a Gardner room or something, chamber in the State House in Massachusetts.
So your family must have settled Gardner, Mass, too.
Yeah, it's Gardner, Mass, where they do a lot of the furniture stuff. Yeah, like Winchendon Furniture and everything. Great furniture. Yeah, exactly, dude, exactly. And I don't know what river they were using for the mills. Be interested to find out the history of that. It's a very pretty area, too. Yeah. So
nowadays with the foliage and everything, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, you know where I would love to go is out on the Mohawk Trail, you know, heading west towards Tanglewood. Wow, man, so nice. And by the way,
years prior, I would drive up to Bangor, you know, just to see Mr. Stephen King's mansion there.
And
all the foliage up 95, Route 95 there.
Oh, man, I love that whole route. In fact, it's funny you should bring it up, because right here, that's a picture of Rocky. And that's Stephen King. Rocky and Stephen were very good friends. He did a bunch of nonfiction publications about Stephen King's stuff. Wow. And so Rocky was a great friend with Stephen King. And Rocky is a libertarian, was a libertarian from Australia. And yet he was super close friends with Stephen King. Another pro-liberty guy is the editor of Cemetery Dance magazine, Richard Chismar. And he and Stephen King have been friends for a long, long time. And so, you know, I often have a lot of mixed feelings about what Stephen King might say here or there. I know his son, and I know his son Joe, and you know they're nice guys.
Joe Hill personally.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Last time I saw Joe, I gave him a copy of Genesis of the Daleks in Barnes and Noble in Nashua.
Yeah,
he was there speaking and stuff like that. We're acquainted. We're not like super friendly. He lives out on the seacoast of New Hampshire.
Yeah,
and phenomenal writer. Just great writing. But again, left of center, left wing. But we have some commonalities, and they're nice guys, you know, they're nice people. Rocky was just an amazing dude. And as I mentioned, he and my friend Lisa Morton wrote this book on the witch hunts. And so that's sort of our topic, because it is weird to have a family tied to these things. I've just heard that in Massachusetts now there's an ex post facto attempt to try to clear the names yes. of the people who have been tried. So yeah. we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's talk about the witch trials and the witch hunts. And we'll start it off with this image. There's Stephen King and Rocky again. This is Witch Hunts, a graphic history of the burning times by Rocky Wood. Rest in peace, Rocky. He had folks who are unaware, he got Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and he was aware of it, and he made very, very smart investments to allow him. He was the head of the Horror Writers Association, president for many years, was a terrific guy. I've got video of us out on the Brighton Pier having a great time watching the seagulls. I got a photograph of him with seagull behind him over the ocean, over the British, the English Channel. Yeah. And, it's really weird. He's gone, but he was such a peaceful, kind, fun guy. And he knew that he was going to start to degenerate, so he invested in things early on, got a tablet, got a wheelchair, and all the things that he would need. His son was there to back him up, and he continued to travel to the official Horror Writers events, continued to do things. And as I mentioned to you, Chris, the last time I saw Rocky, he was so devastated by ALS, he was still available to chat at a Horror Writers convention, and we had a great chat. We took a picture giving a fellow friend of ours the finger. And Rocky raised his finger and gave the guy the finger. It was just a joke. And the last thing he wrote to me was, "I love you."
Oh.
And that was really, really something. He was amazing, amazing. What a great, great guy. And wow. I knew I was saying goodbye.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. But Rocky, coming from a libertarian standpoint, Lisa Morton, the co-writer on it, and Greg Chapman, just to I'll see if I can enlarge this for everybody here. Let me just do this, see if I can make it bigger. Greg Chapman is another Aussie who did the artwork, and the artwork is really, really cool in this book. It won the Bram Stoker Award in 2012 for superior achievement in graphic novel. Yeah. And it's not really a novel. It's nonfiction. And what's really interesting about it is, as I found out, there's a lot more to just the witch trials than Salem. So, Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit, because you've got even more on this Halloween that you can tell us about the witch trials, but what's your angle as we open it up for the viewers at Rockfin, Rumble, or After the Fact, or Twitter?
Well, I've been to Gallows Hill. I'm not sure if you've ever been there. It's very haunting.
I have driven by it, but we never got out of the car.
Yeah, we got out of the car, and they have some memorials to the victims there. Whether you believe they were actually possessed by witch, or whether you believe they're witches or not, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a couple of theories that have gone around over the years in terms of what may have caused mass hysteria, including even bread and fungus on bread.
Yeah, they thought it was like maybe yeast psychosis, yeast poisoning, and things like that, and it is very strange because this happened to so many people. They couldn't understand why so many people would dive into such delusions.
Exactly. And, they would see what we would think of as the modern day witch, like on broomsticks, and they'd see demons and things like that.
It's Chris, it's almost as if they had a government narrative about some deadly thing that would destroy all of their towns. And they just had to act in unison and take care of it. You know what I'm saying, man?
I do. And there's a correlation that I think off the air you and I have talked about, where you actually dove into it, where they would, accuse people of being witches, and then even werewolves, which we'll get to in a little bit, even in Europe, where they would use that as an excuse just to take someone's land.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And in fact, I'll go right over to it and show the cover again, if people get the opportunity to check this out. In the research, and Rocky informed me of this, I actually did an interview with Rocky and Lisa. Rocky's voice is a little bit, his breathing is a little funky, so his voice is a little bit odd in it. But I think it's still over at my Liberty Conspiracy, audios on Podomatic. And, he and Lisa explained that as they started to do the research for the Witch Hunts graphic nonfiction book, and that's what it is, it's nonfiction, but it's all artwork and so on. What they discovered was that Salem was not an isolated place. This happened all over the place, all around the world. And what they found was it was political forces that were they levered off of this spiritual fear and religious fear. And once one person in a political area found out about what somebody else was doing, they used it as a way to target people and make them give up their land. So it was a way to acquire property. It was a way to knock out people who had very valuable property. And that's what really made it spread, because political forces realized it was a valuable weapon to use against people to accuse them of witchcraft, and either they would be found guilty or their reputation would be so bad that they would have to leave, and then they would sell their land at a rock bottom price.
Very cheap. Yeah. And a very, very cheap price that they were 100% ripped off on.
And they looked into the claims about, you know, could it have been, you know, some sort of psychosis brought on by yeast in the bread, that sort of thing. And they said, you know, no, not that case. It was right. A way. And they would even pay off people to claim, you know, some of this. So like the story out of Salem, younger people making the claims, as we see in the play, you know, and they say, oh, and the crucible and that sort of thing. Was it? Yeah, it was the crucible, right?
Yeah, the crucible. Yeah.
And they would pay people off. They'd be like, you know, here's a person in a bad state. I'll give them some money. You say you saw this. You just keep sticking with it. And they were all set. And it happened over and over again.
And boom, you have your corroboration right there.
It was
made up corroboration.
Yeah, exactly. In some cases, you'd get people who would speak up because they had been jilted by someone or something. It was just such an easy weapon, you know, spreading the pathogen of witchcraft all around the place, happening in the 1600s when, of course, you know, word was word of mouth. Yeah. And it was very easy to quietly, you know, not leave a paper trail. You just make sure you supported somebody, you know.
Hey, money talks and you know what walks, right?
Yeah, big time, big time. So tell us a little more about your angle as you started to look into the witch trials. You've got so much fascinating stuff that you sent my way, and I'll click on anything you might want me to bring up.
Yeah, I actually have a history.com article link about before America had witch trials, Europe had werewolf trials.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you see that or not.
Yeah, I'll go over to it here and show it on the screen, and here we go. Yes.
Yeah, so I was doing research for a werewolf movie a couple years ago, and I wanted to kind of do a different take on the werewolf genre, and I came across this whole thing about where thing I had never heard of before, where it was women werewolves. And it was tied to this phenomenon that was over in Europe about 200 years before the Salem witch trials, even, where witches and werewolves would be kind of connected with accusations of being werewolves and witches, but they would be like together in a weird way. And they would go on trial, and this is like in France and Ireland, all over Europe. And it turned out that it was just people, mentally disabled people, or you actually had like beggars and vagrants, things like that, you know, people, quote unquote, undesirables, that kind of thing. And they would be accused of mutilating and eating children, even.
Oh, Jesus.
There were probably some guilty parties, like pedophiles and actual killers, that were being labeled this thing, too, like a werewolf and such. But for the most part, it was kind of mirrors the Salem thing, where most likely they were not witches, and that's my opinion. I mean, you know,
it's wild to think now. And, you know, we have our lycanthropy legend, this idea of you get bitten by a werewolf, and then, you know, as the moon comes up, then, yeah, that sort of thing. You go into that phase. Who is it? Robert McCammon's got a great novel called The Wolf's Hour, where in World War II, the guy's a spy in Europe, gets bitten by a werewolf. and starts to turn into a werewolf. And then as he's a werewolf, he ages at a rapid rate compared to what he would normally age as a human being.
Yeah.
And when he comes out of it, he's really exhausted and so on. But it's a fascinating, it's a great, great story. Around the time that he came out with They Live, or They Thirst. They Thirst, I'm thinking of the movie.
They Thirst,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting because on this piece, you know, we have here, right here, Lycaon transforms into a wolf, which is where we get lycanthropy in Greek mythology.
Yeah.
Lycaon, king of Arcadia, tested Zeus by serving him the roasted flesh of his son, Nyctimus, in order to see whether Zeus was truly omniscient. Well, that was a big mistake in a couple ways, wasn't it?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah, and Chris, if you don't mind, Chris Graves is our guest, folks. I want to read the opening of this. Very interesting opening here. Some 200 years before the witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts courts in Europe were convicting men and some women of transforming into werewolves and mutilating and eating children.
Now, they don't really touch upon the witch contingent or the witch thing, but a lot of these cases weren't just werewolves. They were werewolf-witch, like, teams. It's kind of odd.
Wow. So you had this supernatural devil curse thing, but not necessarily in the tradition of the witch, as we know today, or as the cult might have sung, right?
Exactly.
Okay, or as the Sonics might have sung, of course, about Hillary Clinton a couple decades before.
Yeah,
but she's the witch.
I can believe that wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I think in that interview that she did for 60 Minutes where she was laughing about Gaddafi, didn't she say, "We came, we saw, I turned into a wolf, he died." Is that what she said?
Yeah, something about that. And,
she was like,
yeah, she cackled, and then a house fell on her, and then
I don't think we don't need that kind of supernatural to know that she's an evil creature, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting because you say, as you mentioned, the punishments were sometimes as gruesome as the alleged crimes. In Germany in 1589, executioners strapped accused werewolf Peter Strump to a cartwheel, removed his skin with hot pincers, and chopped off his head before burning his body at the stake. Stump's head, no pun intended, attached to a wooden pole carved into the likeness of a wolf, was later displayed as a warning to others tempted to consort with the devil.
Yeah, that's not a timeshare that I would sign up for.
Return with more from the great Chris Graves here on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Thanks for listening, and find Liberty Conspiracy live at 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on Rumble and Rockfin. You can listen live or after the fact.
Are you a business owner? Are you confused by the complexity of the tax laws? We can help. I'm Dan Pilla, and I've been helping business owners solve tax problems for over 40 years. My book, The Small Business Tax Guide, shows proven ways to avoid all the common business tax problems. Don't risk your business. Go to danpilla.com to order your copy. That's danpilla.com. Order now and get a free 15-minute call directly with me, a $99 value. Go to danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
USA News Update. The economy added just 150,000 jobs in October, reflecting a slowdown in the labor market. The unemployment rate rose slightly to 3.9%. President Biden expressing his condolences for the victims of last month's mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine. He paid a visit to a memorial near the restaurant where the tragic incident occurred.
This tragedy opens a painful wound all across the country. Too many Americans have lost loved ones or survive the trauma of gun violence.
During his visit, Biden met with first responders, healthcare providers, and some of the families affected. Americans are preparing for the end of daylight saving time this weekend. On Sunday, clocks in most states across the U.S. will be set back an hour. While not everyone is pleased with the change, efforts to eliminate it in Congress have not made any progress. John Schaefer, USA News.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? There's a tremendous price war among the major term life companies. Rates have dropped dramatically in the past 2 years. For example, a man age 45 non-tobacco user, $1 million of coverage is only $75 per month, level for the next 10 years. Or a man age 50 non-tobacco user can buy $500,000 of coverage for a monthly premium of only $110. Guaranteed not to change for the next 20 years. That's right, level rates for 20 years. And if you're a smoker, we have great rates for you as well. At the Term Lifeline, we specialize in policies of $500,000 and above. So if you're looking for new or replacement term life insurance, call right now for a free quote.
Rates and availability may vary by state. Sample rate quotes are based on preferred non-tobacco underwriting exam required to qualify.
800-430-1891. 800-430-1891. 800-430-1891. That's 800-430-1891.
Every day we take steps to keep the people we love safe, but some health risks are easy to miss. Ticks hiding in the yard can spread germs that can cause Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Mice searching for sources of food can spread bacteria and disease. Mosquitoes breed in standing water and can transmit illnesses like West Nile virus and Zika virus. Cockroaches are drawn to water in the home and can leave behind allergens that trigger asthma attacks. Stinging insects attack in defense of their nests and send more than 500,000 people to the emergency room every year. Household pests are a threat to our health. Learn what you can do to protect your family at pestworld.org.
We still do email. Drop your email address in the entry box at freetalklive.com, and you'll be kept in the loop with Free Talk Live.
We continue on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live, digging into legends, lore, and mysterious crimes with guest Chris Graves. I'm Gardner Goldsmith. Thanks for tuning in. And I had no idea that the werewolf lycanthropy legend was that old and that well established, that they had trials like the witch trials that actually preceded the witch trials
even before.
You told me. Yeah, yeah, Chris, that's an amazing thing. And when you and I were talking about this on the phone, it blew me away because, like, oh, yeah, did you know they had werewolf trials? I'm like, huh?
I only knew that because of doing research for this werewolf witch horror movie screenplay that I wanted to still do. And wow. I was fascinated because I'm like, that isn't the basis of my werewolf screenplay, but that could be the basis for another screenplay altogether, just the backstory.
You know, that you could do a mini series all about that. That would be amazing.
I knew
nothing about
any of this. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the werewolf trials from the papal inquisitors to the secular courts. Like, they actually put people on trial like this, right?
Yeah, through the 15th and the 16th, 17th centuries. And they would basically kind of mirror with Salem. Like, you know, in Salem, they would literally crush people to death. And in Danvers, Mass, where a lot of the actual accusations of the witch trials themselves.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of it wasn't in Salem proper. It was outside of Salem. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, and they actually, they have a memorial for all of the accused in Danvers. That's even bigger than the Gallows Hill one, where there's a couple of concrete stones there with, you know, like Mary Proctor and people's names like that, you know, and how they died and everything. But in Danvers, they have all the people that were, you know, thrown in the water, you know, and drowned, because that was the idea. If they didn't drown, then, yep, they're witches. So they were damned if they do, damned if they don't, as they would say, you know?
Well, how does that tie into... they absolutely were. It's like the Monty Python skit. You know, yeah. It's like, oh, we'll throw in the water.
It's like you're going to drown, and there's no winning here, you know?
Yeah. If you drown, we knew you weren't a witch because you would have saved yourself. All right. Good
now
enough.
You're dead, so it doesn't matter. So you're not going to care, I guess.
Yeah,
you know?
You're totally cool. Now, that, it's interesting because you have the werewolf stuff preceding this by 200 years.
You've
got the story in Europe, exactly, and it goes all the way to the Pope. And I'll just mention this real quick as we start to go into the witches. And then there's another facet of it that you brought up, and I didn't know about this either. Yeah. In 1521, inquisitors appointed by the Pope presided over several trials of alleged werewolfry. Two shepherds, Pierre Bugeaud and Michel Verdun, confessed to making a pact with the devil in exchange for food, meeting with a man in black who gave them an ointment that turned them into werewolves, then attending midnight witch gatherings and hunting and eating children. Both were convicted and burned at the stake, along with a third who refused to confess. Now, I'm not sure, but I think he held his hand up. The number was 14, and his nickname was Skippy, but I'm not sure. You know what I'm saying? I don't know.
You never know.
But, yeah. And they hung out with an artist who... does spirit cooking, but anyway,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit about anything you want to add about the werewolf things. But then, as the universal monsters might do, let's talk about the vampire hunting in New England, the vampire trials, because that also is something I didn't know. But any other stuff about the werewolf stuff that you might want to mention?
It's just that, like, the punishment seemed to be even more ghastly than what some of these men and women were being accused of. I mean, mutilating and eating children is probably the worst of the worst, but they would literally, like, peel their skin back and really torture them pretty much to death.
Couldn't they just take him to a Taylor Swift concert with the governor of New Jersey? Isn't that torture enough?
Or Beyonce, something like that, you know? Double bill.
But, I can see it now. It's like Monty Python. Fetch the comfy chair.
That's right. Yeah, the werewolf trials, other than what we pretty much covered. And, I mean, there's really nothing else besides the fact that they were not just here, because there were a couple of isolated werewolf things here, too.
Yeah.
That weren't so much in Salem, but, you know, around the country, but... Yeah, no, they definitely went into the vampire accusations in the 1800s, especially in Rhode Island, with probably the most famous case, a woman named Mercy Brown.
Brown. Let's see about the Mercy Brown thing. And I see here that, according to history.com, the werewolf trials themselves continued sporadically in the 17th century in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
But in Netherlands and Eastern Europe. But eventually they sort of petered out as industrialization grew. And yet over in New England, as you say, you got Mercy Brown. I've got the click to allthat'sinteresting.com. Mercy Brown's story might be, one of the history's craziest vampire incidents. So tell us about this. And again, you know, what's weird is it's this sort of perverse interest that you can't help but have. It's a curiosity, but these people suffered. They were killed, they were tortured, they had their land taken from them. We got 1892, Mercy Brown. Tell us a little bit about this, Chris Graves.
Well, her family, it was during at the time when there was a big tuberculosis, I hate saying pandemic, but there was a whole bunch of tuberculosis going around. What would be the proper phrase for that? That's not plandemic or pandemic or whatever, but just...
Well, it depends on the level, I suppose, of what it was, but there certainly was of an epidemic of it. Yeah,
epidemic. That's the word. Okay. Yeah.
At least within the United States. If it was across many many countries and it was deadly enough, they would have called it a pandemic. But if it's just in the United States, it would have been an epidemic and that sort of thing. But that's just the way that they've done their terminology. And of course, who cares? Because who's going to change it, right? So yeah.
Well, yeah, and Webster's will change the definition anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But other than that, no, I went to public school, so I needed that pointed out.
And by the way, Mercy Brown is seen as such an example of by the statists of why you need to have lockdowns, you need to isolate people. And they still do it. They still cite Mercy Brown, like, oh, that evil Mercy Brown. She continued to do stuff even though she was killing people. It's like, no, what are you talking about?
She was dead and buried. That's the thing that people don't realize. But she suffered tuberculosis infections, and then I guess other members of her family did too. Mary Eliza was the first to die of the disease. And then Mary Olive, a sister, according to her gravestone, in 1891, daughter Mercy and son Edwin also contracted the disease. Friends and neighbors of the family believed that one of the dead family members was a vampire, although they did not use the name they didn't use the vampire name and as a cause of Edwin's illness. But this was in accordance to threads of contemporary folklore, which linked multiple deaths to one family to undead activity. Consumption.
Go ahead.
No, go for it. No.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the thing about it is that tuberculosis was pretty widely known at the time. Frederick Bastiat died of tuberculosis in the 1840s, you know. So it wasn't uncommon. This is in Rhode Island near the turn of the century, the 1880s, 1890s, right?
That's right. What had happened was consumption was really poorly understood at that time, and it was the subject of a lot of superstition. And I think the Salem witch trial period was kind of under the same umbrella in a way. And I think same with the European werewolf trials, superstition played a large role in convincing the public of a lot of this stuff. I feel like. What do you think?
Well, I think it definitely was the case. But again, you know, I think there's also this tendency that we see today with the whole pandemic lockdown mindset of the people in political authority, the people who are seen as, you know, the establishment people. Well, I've got the authority, so listen to what I say. And then they talk to other people, and then they keep pushing this authoritarian sort of thing where you just can't do something unless you do it their way. This tendency for authoritarianism and telling other people how to live, especially backed up with this sort of amorphous fear mongering that if you don't do it this way, well, you know, things are going to fall apart. Just look at this woman, and they can selectively, especially back then, they would be very easy to start picking out anecdotal instances and saying, well, now, you know, this is going to apply to you and get people fearful. Really very, very tragic. And in fact, what's interesting about this is you can see how this at the turn of the century and the early 1900s, we had the Jacobson decision in Massachusetts about the jab, saying that, the state can compel someone to get a jab. And then that led, plus another Supreme Court decision, that led to the sterilization of all sorts of women under so-called public health to remove their bad blood from the future population because they might be seen as mentally retarded or danger or something like that. Unbelievable stuff, you know, and it's all part of this we can control sort of thing. So this mindset is it seems to be universal, whatever era it is, right?
Yeah, and that's it's just where really crazy things can be accepted, you know, under mass hysteria. And George Brown, the father, the father of the Brown family or whatever, he was persuaded to have all the members that had died in his family have their bodies exhumed because they wanted to see if the bodies were decomposed or not.
And this is where we go to that Smithsonian link that you sent me, the Great New England Vampire Panic. So from this, was it because of the tuberculosis or other things that from this
people think in modern times that it was tuberculosis. And what had happened was they figured that his wife and his other daughter, their bodies had the proper amount of decomposition at the time. But surprisingly, Mercy, she had almost no decomposition and still had blood in her heart. So that's why she got pegged as being the vampire that infected the rest of the family. So what had happened was they cut her heart out and they turned it into ash, and they actually turned it into like, they mixed the ashes with water to create like a tonic and was given to Edwin, the father, to try to cure, you know, his tuberculosis at the time. And he pretty much, it was too, he actually died 2 months later, so it didn't really work, you know. But the idea of just carving out Mercy's heart, because it had a little bit of blood left in it, and mixing the ashes from it with water would actually cure Edwin.
Wow. Let's go to this little bit here, Chris. Our guest is Chris Graves. And, Chris, I want to read to the audience the opening of this Smithsonian Magazine piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the Great Vampire Panic of New England. So here it is, originally written in October of 2012. Children playing near a hillside gravel mine found the first graves. One ran home to tell his mother, who was skeptical at first, until the boy produced a skull. Because this was Griswold, Connecticut in 1990, police initially thought the burials might be the work of a local serial killer named Michael Ross. They taped off the area as a crime scene, but the brown, decaying bones turned out to be more than a century old. The Connecticut State archaeologist Nick Ballantoni soon determined that the hillside contained a colonial-era farm cemetery. New England is full of such unmarked family plots, and the 29 burials were typical of the 1700s and early 1800s. The dead, many of them children, were laid to rest in thrifty Yankee style, in simple wood coffins without jewelry or even much clothing, their arms resting by their sides or crossed over their chests. Except that is for burial number 4. Bellantoni was interested in the grave even before the excavation began. It was one of only 2 stone crypts in the cemetery, and it was partially visible from the mine face. Scraping away soil with flat-edged shovels, and then brushes and bamboo picks, the archaeologist and his team worked through several feet of earth before reaching the top of the crypt. When Bellantoni lifted the first of the large flat rocks that formed the roof, he uncovered the remains of a red-painted coffin and a pair of skeletal feet. They lay, he remembers, in perfect anatomical position. But when he raised the next stone, Bellantoni saw the rest of the individual had been completely rearranged. The skeleton had been beheaded, skull and thigh bones rested atop the ribs and vertebrae. It looked like a skull and crossbones motif, a Jolly Roger. I'd never seen anything like it, Bellantoni recalls. Subsequent analysis showed that the beheading, along with other injuries, included rib fractures, occurred roughly five years after death. Somebody had also smashed the coffin. The other skeletons in the grave hillside were packaged for reburial, but not J.B., as the 50-ish male skeleton from the 1830s came to be called, because the initials spelled out in brass tacks on it, because of the initials on his coffin lid.
Yeah.
So they shipped them to the National Museum of Health Medicine, and one colleague asked, "Ever heard of the Jewett City vampires?"
Yep.
This is absolutely fascinating. Jewett City, Connecticut, 1854. Townspeople had exhumed several corpses suspected to be vampires that were rising from their graves to kill the living.
Yeah.
A few newspaper accounts of these events survived. Had the Griswold grave been desecrated for the same reason? So,
well,
I know. Yeah.
There's a little correction, just so that people, they're not like, "Oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about." I was crossing the streams, as they said in Ghostbusters.
I've got a story about Ghostbusters.
It was
either tonight or tomorrow, actually.
It was actually Edwin was the son and the brother of Mercy Brown. Edwin died 2 months later after having that tonic that was mixed with his sister's heart, the ashes and everything. But Father George was the only member of the family not to contract tuberculosis. But here's the other thing that's really intriguing, especially in terms of fiction.
Yeah.
There's a lot of scholars that believe Bram Stoker, besides the Vlad the Impaler, you know, backstory of Dracula, you know, the real life Vlad the Impaler, the other elements to his novel, Dracula, a lot of scholars believe that he read newspaper articles that came over, you know, from America about Mercy Brown for Dracula.
Well, it makes some sense. It makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. And of course, Stoker had come up with his idea for Dracula when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
And had sort of sketched out some of the things about, you know, Harker going over and visiting and, you know, being involved with the real estate game and things like that. And that whole idea of having a novel that includes letters.
Yeah.
Very novel in a way, you know, that there's this whole other story that Harker is telling of his terrible experience at the castle. Absolutely fascinating. And,
it's like a story within the story. I love that.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the timing of it is pretty spot on, you know?
Yeah. So there are scholars out there that maintain that besides Vlad the Impaler, the other component to Bram Stoker's Dracula was Exeter, Rhode Island's Mercy Brown.
Wow. Well, Chris, let me ask you this. Now, we know that if we look at stories like Edgar Allan Poe, and David Knight has mentioned this, Edgar Allan Poe's Premature Burial.
Wow.
Stephen King wrote a very good story called, I think, Autopsy Room 13. You know, we have these instances of people getting catalepsy or something like it where they appear to be dead or unmoving and then they awaken later.
That's where the term Saved by the Bell comes from, my friend, because they literally would have a bell attached to a string. So if someone woke up in their casket, someone would hear them and come dig them back up. Is that where you're going? I'm sorry if it was.
No, you're anticipating this perfectly. And I don't know how long that lasted, but it definitely
quite a
seemed
while.
To be. Yeah. And I know that they did this sort of thing in Ireland in particular.
Yeah.
They did it in other places in Europe, and they also did it in some places in New England that I've heard, but I don't really know that much about it.
I haven't looked too far into it other than one of my favorite Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes. And you would think it would be something right out of, you know, Rod Serling's Twilight Zone or something.
Yeah,
Alfred Hitchcock Presents had an episode where a guy, a prisoner, I believe, at a jail, a prison rather, faked his own death and made a pact with the prison caretaker, cemetery caretaker or whatever, that once he was, you know, once he was able to escape after his funeral, that he would repay him somehow. And spoiler alert for a show from literally from 1951, I think. Albert Hitchcock Presents. At the end of the episode, the guy is pulling the string because he woke up after being given whatever shot to put him to sleep or whatever for the funeral.
Yeah.
He wakes up and he lights a match, I believe, inside the coffin. And he realizes that the guy that's supposed to come and dig him up is in the coffin with him because he had a heart attack. And it's totally a Twilight Zone thing, but Alfred Hitchcock Presents was the show. So that's kind of where they were inspired by, those old-time stories about people allegedly. And I believe there were a couple of cases where people were dug up. And
yeah.
I just don't have the articles in front of me right now. But, yeah, that term, Saved by the Bell, was not just Screech and Zach Morris and all that. It wasn't just a TV show from the 80s, a goofy one.
Right.
It was an actual term because people would wake up all the time after being declared dead, having fully fledged funerals, wakes, and they would wake up because it was such a deep, deep sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, people would ascribe some demonic possession to this.
Oh,
that they are actually coming back from the dead or something, right?
Yeah. Well, there's that, too. It makes it even more, how do you explain that away in those times where?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And which reminds me, you know, you talk about the Alfred Hitchcock Presents story.
Yeah.
I wonder if that inspired Richard Matheson and his son, R.C. They wrote a story together called Where There's a Will.
Yeah.
And, I don't know if you've read it, Chris, but I won't give away the ending. Yeah. You have?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, a guy wakes up in the coffin, and at first he doesn't know where he is, and it's like there's wood all around him. He's like, where am I? And he reaches in his pocket, and he has a lighter, and he realizes where he is, and he's in a coffin, and he's
Is he buried with the guy that's supposed to come dig him up?
No.
Oh, okay.
He's all alone, but he's got to get out of there because he knows he's going to run out of oxygen. First he freaks out, and then he realizes, wait a minute. And all he has is his lighter.
Yeah.
And he finds a way to get out of the coffin.
Oh.
And then he's trying to get back to his wife. And the where there's a will is a double meaning because the guy uses his own will to get out. But then.
Then there's a will that he left behind.
Yeah. There's a will for inheritance. Yeah.
There's a relative out of the
will. Yes. Yeah. It's great, great story. It's super short.
So
and the ending.
Quentin must have taken that inspiration from that same story then for Kill Bill. When she
I bet. You're right. Absolutely. Yeah. Just awesome, awesome stuff. Really cool. You know, and so you're talking about like, you talk about Rhode Island and you know, tuberculosis and things like that. Let's shift over into the final bit that we might want to discuss now. And I think we should open it up because it requires Lizzie Borden, the Lizzie Borden stories. Plenty more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live, coming up.
This is an urgent warning. America is heading for another major financial disaster at an alarming rate. We could see stock prices fall as much as 50%, but this time the crash could be more violent and come faster than you ever imagined. We are Advantage Gold, America's most trusted precious metals company, and we are here to sound the alarm that winter is coming for investors. And now is the time to take actions that may help protect and secure your portfolio with physical precious metals. Want to help protect your hard-earned money before it's too late? Call Advantage Gold at 800-900-8000 and request our free gold and silver survival kit today. Mention that you heard us on the radio and learn how you could get up to $1,000 in free silver coins. The number is 800-900-8000. Call now to get your free survival kit and see if you qualify for $1,000 in free silver today.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor. Check with your financial advisor before investing.
Call 800-900-8000.
I had no idea it would destroy my life, but before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers. There's only 4 days' worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to gcnfood.com, gcnfood.com.